You are listening pretty late. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. As many of you know, I have a beautiful 12-year-old boy named Declan who was born medically fragile and throughout his life has met many challenges. And I saw the movie Shape of Water, and one of the scenes that I loved was when the woman, the main character, who is unable to speak, expresses her complete joy at having someone in her life who doesn't look at her like she's broken. And my goal in life is to make the world a better place for Declan and to help him, reach those potential, beautiful moments in his life that we all aspire to. And one of the things that I have been blessed with is being able to talk to so many people who are going through this adventure, through these challenges, and so many researchers and specialists and doctors who are dedicated to finding answers, to providing information about treatments, to connecting families to the resources that are out there. Joining me right now is Dr. Lata Surya, who is here to tell us about some research that you might be able to join and help families all over the country. This is remarkable. How are you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a, we were talking before our interview, and I always let people know that I'm recording this. So thank you so much for coming into the studio. I know you have to be very busy. You are a part of a research program called by the Simons Foundation.
Yes. So we are at Rush, a part of a 25-site network that the Simons Foundation is funding called SPARC.
Okay.
And SPARC is this pretty revolutionary idea that if we can use technology to bring together and build a community of families and researchers and practitioners that are invested in, as you said, finding a way to make things easier, make things better, have people live up to their fullest potential. How do we do this through the technology that we have? So this project really is this collaborative effort where we're trying to get families to register online to be part of an autism research registry. And then the first step from that registry is the first idea from that registry is to build a genetic database.
Okay.
So families would go online to our website, and which we'll talk about later, I'm sure. And then they provide a little bit of information about themselves, about their child. If they're a child, adults can register if they are able to. And then if they would like to participate in the genetic study, they would send saliva samples. We'd send them kits home and they send them back. We have lots of ways for families to participate. We do it at Rush. We go out into the community. We've had great community partners that have helped us out with this over the last 2 years. So we're very excited that this is in Chicago, that this is an opportunity for us and for families.
No, come closer.
This is an opportunity for us and for families in the Chicago area. And we think that it's going to really build upon itself over the next decades to help us understand autism.
Has there been a collection of information about genetic information like this before?
Not to this magnitude.
Okay. And why is that? What has been the obstacle for research in autism?
Yeah, I mean, we've made so many advances in understanding the genetics of autism, and what SPARC is built upon are the legacy of these other studies, which are really important.
Sure.
So Autism Speaks, the older foundations like NAR and CAN have each figured out ways at that point in time to understand the genetics of autism. And so in the past, it's been a fairly involved process where families would come into our clinics, these medical centers all over the country, and we would spend 6 to 12 hours trying to understand their family, get their family histories. And then the genetic testing was really expensive. And so what we have now is sort of a convergence of advances in the accessibility and level of detail we can get out of genetic testing, as well as the power of the internet to bring everybody's information to us through their home.
Right, because if people have to come to a clinic, that's sort of another challenge for them, because maybe, whether it's maybe therapies throughout the day or the child's at school or an adult who is in a program, there's a lot of different, things that get, anybody having to go to a destination sometimes, they'll put it off or we'll get around to it. But now people can do it from their comfort of their own homes.
Exactly.
So you go online, you go to the website, and you go through it. Now, do people have to have a professional diagnosis of autism? Because sometimes yes. people have it sort of like they have autistic like behaviors, or but it has to be professionally diagnosed.
Yes, some a doctor, pediatrician, mm-hmm. You know, psychologist, somebody has to have told the family that okay. this is part of what their child's profile is. The autism is.
And you and I talked a little bit beforehand that, you know, the way in which we collect information has changed in part because of the diagnosis of autism. How much has that changed over the last 10, 20 years?
It's changed quite a bit. We are still stuck in some ways with a behavioral diagnosis.
Right.
So
there's no blood test you can take. There's no genetic test you can take, which is part of why you guys are doing this research.
Exactly. And so we're in a place where some kids with autism can be detected through sort of fairly straightforward channels. And then others, I mean, we know autism is this massive spectrum. Kids are so diverse. And they change over development. And so we have children and adults who are diagnosed much later and have gone through this diagnostic odyssey of professional after professional. And so, yes, we have a behavioral diagnosis of autism that takes some time. For many families, it's a struggle just to get that diagnosis. Maybe we will be at a point where there are some medical tests that give us an inkling of that this diagnosis might be a concern that families need to sort of consider or might be in the future for them. But even if we don't have a blood test for autism, what we are able to do is to sort of develop this really complex profile, hopefully.
Right.
From family history, from genetics, from behavioral profiles, from learning patterns, and be able to pull together the individual profiles of a person with autism and link treatments to those profiles. And that's the goal.
That's wonderful. It's great that you guys are embarking on such a significant research program. Well, you have already. You've said that this has been going on, 2 years with the Simons Foundation.
2 years with the Simons Foundation, decades yes. for the yeah. autism research community. And then, you know, Rush has, we have our own autism research that we're really invested in looking at treatments and interventions, behavioral and biomedical. And so, you know, as a institution, each institution has their own desire, but for us, it's really sort of offering research to families who might not otherwise hear about it.
Oh, no doubt about it, because, yeah. you know, you sort of, I think some families plateau. And you and I were talking before mm-hmm. we came on the air about my son Declan, mm-hmm. where it's kind of we sort of fall into this pattern of like, I guess this is what it is. And you do need to keep moving forward and make sure that you're up to date on what kind of information is out there. How much did the, you know, sort of the paranoia when we started to see the numbers increase of diagnosis? We started seeing, you know, first we'd heard numbers like it was 1 in 110 and then it was 1 in 70. And then they were saying boys might be 1 in 50. There were several different kinds of mania, I think. Mm-hmm. One was, we're just overdiagnosing, and sort of this dismissiveness of, well, we're just going to call everything, every weird behavior, autistic. Tell us a little bit about how the perhaps misunderstanding of what autism was affected us in the last couple decades.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, we're still facing it, right? You know, on the one hand, there's validation that some of those concerns from, you know, the last 15 years are not true, which we've known, but we know. I mean, the diagnosis has been stabilized for the last 2 years.
Okay.
The last two actually reports, rather. So we're at 1 in 66, and it hasn't changed
okay.
since 2014. So,
but still, that number is daunting.
It's daunting. And for the most part, it's we are better at detecting autism in a variety of forms. You talk about Declan and where his behaviors might have been diagnosed as something else
right.
20 years ago. And we talk about people who are, you know, bright individuals who work in, you know, various situations where they are capitalizing on their skills and they might not have been diagnosed before. So we are capturing different diagnoses under this umbrella of autism, but we can't explain all of it. And that's where the other theories come in.
Right.
Right. And those have really set us back quite a bit. And we still face it. It's a question I get every time I talk to a family about a new diagnosis. Not every time, but most of the time when I talk to a family about a new diagnosis, when we do these kinds of community interviews, and we haven't been able to shake it.
When we come back, let's talk about some of those theories that may have complicated the progress of research for autism and treatment and diagnosis. We are talking to Dr. Lata Surya, who is part of the program. She's here to encourage you if you have a family member who has autism, or you know somebody in your community, in your world, who can perhaps be a part of bringing about change. And that might, it might be next year, it might be 10 years, it might be 50 years, but this is all part of a process that we can all help each other with. And again, you can go to sparkforautism.org/rush, and you can learn more to schedule an appointment at Rush or community event for free, spark@rush.edu. You can also call 312-563-2765. More with a doctor when we come back after this on 720 WGN. You're listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, and we've been talking to Dr. Lata. I had it right a couple times. Yeah. Lata Surya. Am I getting it right?
Yes. Yeah,
thank you so much for really sharing so much information with us. Before the break, we were talking about some of the things that might have gotten in the way, some of the issues, the mythology behind, what autism meant, especially, I think, when the numbers started to become alarming for people. Because we all think back and we go, oh, well, there was that one kid, and we're like, well, it didn't seem like to be at this level of diagnosis. Have the theories that really seemed to grab a hold of people, in particular, whether it was environmental, it was food, it might have been vaccinations, how much did that affect the progress of autism research?
It certainly cast doubt on the intentions and sort of the goals, especially when we think about, we've known autism is a genetic condition from very early on in the research field. But when we have theories about vaccines that take hold, even when the, science has been shown to be faulty,
right,
the science has been withdrawn, and we still have these theories put forth, it has created a level of distrust, I think. And,
yes,
and it's different in different communities. And there's already, in terms of medical research, sometimes a distrust that we face whether we're dealing with autism or not. And so this just added to it. And fortunately, I think that we are slowly coming out of the shadows of that time, but we will probably face those types of questions for a long time to come.
And you are encouraging, we are both encouraging people to participate in this study. Again, tell us a little bit about the Simons Foundation and what the intentions are. Where you're gathering genetic information, and when families do that, will they receive information about their input?
So, great question. So, the overall goal of the Simons Spark Project, right? Spark is the name of the initiative, is really to bring families together into an online autism research registry and community where they're going back and forth researchers. The first goal, though, is to understand the genetics of autism. So, families will provide, if they consent, volunteer their genetic samples through a saliva collection, either in their home or in a clinic. And very small percentage will get back genetic results. But what the goal is right now we have a panel of about 70 genes that we think are associated with autism. And those genes may sort of impact a small percentage of families, but that list will grow. And over time, as that list grows, we'll go back and reanalyze the samples. And so the genetic information is one piece of it, but actually the first and smallest part, I think what motivated us to, as a autism center at Rush and as a research community, is that the Simons Foundation has really thought about what do families need in this online community. And they provided webinars on all sorts of issues that really impact families, and from IEP planning to transition planning to financial planning to how to deal with behaviors, with sleep, with GI issues. So it's really cross. There's a sexual education seminar, webinar that one of our providers at Rush is giving soon. And so they're really thinking deeply about sort of what are the immediate needs.
That's a remarkable program that you guys have going. And I want to, again, encourage family members, if you know somebody that perhaps, you know, doesn't know where to turn for information, for resources, make sure that they have the information. And Rush has an incredible program. We have been at one place for quite a while, and my husband and I keep talking about, you know, because when you first realize that maybe it's autism, the wait times, especially when Declan was born, you know, we would call and ask for an appointment. And when you have this, you're in a state of emergency. When you find out something isn't going the way you had hoped, they would tell us it would be like 6 to 9 months to wait for an appointment. Is that still the case at so many, because so many families are being sort of referred to your program?
It's not just our program. The wait lists for early interventions are somewhere between, I mean, 6 months is actually not terrible.
That was 12 years ago.
That was 12 years ago. Yeah. 2 years, we've heard at some places. So, this is not about Spark, but this is really about where much of the research is going, is we are, as a community, really needing to find ways to put the diagnosis, the treatment of autism outside of specialty clinics. Our wait lists, depending on which doctors, we have a lot of doctors at Rush that see people with autism. We try not to centralize it to one specialty place, because it's a condition that impacts 1 in 66 children.
And the sooner you have a diagnosis, the sooner you can begin to use services like therapies, intervention that can help them.
Exactly. And education for families. If you know this is the part of the profile of your child, that autism is part of the profile, the information that families get from that diagnosis and the communities that they're, as you know, that they're brought into to get for support are really important. And so the wait lists are long. The diagnosis is important. It's, you know, all sorts of obstacles are there to get the diagnosis in terms of reimbursement and that sort of thing. But there are more and more providers who are becoming comfortable with serving people and families with autism. And that's what we need. We just need more people to start saying, okay, we can do this.
Point me in their direction so I can help them get on the same page with you.
Yeah. So, you know, Rush, we have many providers, both in pediatrics and psychiatry. And, so it's not just in one department. We have Lurie is a great program. We have Advocate. We have partners that we work with on Spark, which is really amazing. So for us to recruit Chicagoland families, it can't just be one hospital. Right?
No, not at all. Again, Spark is a program that you're working with to gather information so that we can move forward, so that more people can have access to doctors, to treatment, to diagnosis.
Exactly.
And, you know, I wonder, how does the study that you're doing differ from government research?
Mm-hmm. So for the government to have funded something like this, it would have taken several years to get all the different levels of approval and initiative. And what the Simons Foundation and Spark has been able to do is to make a decision that we're going to use what people are using. We're going to use the web. We're going to use the autism centers and the hospitals that are serving these people with autism. And we're going to do this on our own, and we're going to see how it works. And it was a risk.
Yeah.
And it's a risk that, frankly, has paid off. We have, I think it's 50,000 families that are individuals that have registered across the country in 2 years. There's 2,000 adults, 15,000 children that have registered. And so it's happening. And I think that we'll see useful information at many levels coming out of this kind of initiative.
This is such an important development for families today, tomorrow, for people who, you know, are still seeking answers, or, you know, and to also help families realize that they're not alone, that they're not the only ones. And the program that you offer, you're also inviting them to participate in webinars and to find out more about the resources in their community. I want to encourage, again, anyone who would like to participate in the Spark program to go to email first at spark@rush.edu. That's spark@rush.edu. You can also call 312-563-2765. And if you want to find out more information, the website is sparkforautism.org/rush. Is there anything else you want to make sure that our listeners know before we go?
Yeah, so sometimes it's hard to get those saliva samples. We thought it was easy. Sometimes it's hard.
Really?
It is. It's.
Do you have the swab? Or do you have
swabs?
Okay, because
yeah,
a spitting one might be hard for some people, but yes.
Right. So we have swabs, but the swabs can take 30 like little times. And, you know, we're here to help you do those collections. So
Okay. We
do on-site events at Community Partners. We have one coming up at Have Dreams in Park Ridge this Saturday.
I know the folks at Have Dreams.
Yeah, they're great partners for us. They've hosted events for us for Spark a couple of times now. And so we're at the Park Ridge location on Saturday to get families who are able to, you know, so you don't have to travel so far. And if you just don't want to deal with it, come to our Park Ridge on-site events. We have on-site events, and then you can call those numbers to also get information about just coming into our clinics.
And so the on-site events are listed on the website as
They're
well?
They're listed on the website, and if you either call the number, which you have, I should memorize it.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's 312-563-2765, and we'll make sure it's up on my Facebook page too, but go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, or email the spark@rush.edu. We can send you all the information. You can register simply through emailing or calling, and you'll get a call back. So we know that, you know, even something that we're trying to make, you know, that you could do online at night, we know that there are barriers that we can't anticipate. And so we're here to help figure it out.
Doc, thanks so much. And to all the researchers, everyone that's making this possible to give families hope. I can't thank you.
Well, thank you for having us on the program and giving us the time to talk about this study.
We'll have you back.
Okay,
more after this on 720 WGN.